He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends. Time for your daily minimum adult requirement of sanity. The Tom Hartman Program. Broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border. Glad to be with you. Thank you for joining us today. George W. Bush yesterday asking about Splash Day. This part of a larger theme that should rattle the homophobes. I have to say, first of all, I want to be the first to say, I think that it would be absolutely wonderful if we had a gay president. I'm all in favor of having a gay president. I'm all in favor of having a woman as president. Seriously and genuinely, I think that people who have been members of oppressed classes or in minorities have a better understanding of what it's like to struggle to achieve the American dream in a nation where, in some cases, the American dream is more rhetorical than it is real. And therefore, you know, I would be all in favor of that. But don't think Bush is the guy. Although there's these strange things coming up. Bush, yesterday in Galveston, do you still have Splash Day? Turns out Splash Day is a fully gay and lesbian event on the beaches, by the way. And there's laughter in the room. And then he says, you have to be a baby boomer to know what I'm talking about. Everybody's laughing. He says, I'm not saying whether I came or not on Splash Day. No, I'm not going to comment on that. I'm just saying, do you have Splash Day? And people are wondering, what's he talking about? You know, I think it back when he was a teenager, it was probably like a wet T-shirt contest or something. The way he was, ha, 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 you know, his kind of in-joke, you know, laughing it up. But nobody there got it. Maybe some of the old folks, but not many of the other folks. On Jay Leno's show last night, the First Lady, Laura Bush, was on, and Jay talked about how when Prince Abdullah and Prince Bandar come to the Crawford Ranch, they walk and hold hands with George, and they kiss when they greet. And he said, does this cause you any jealousy? And she says, it was actually very sweet. And he says, you're a very understanding wife. But the real story, the real down story of this thing, is that we have no energy policy. We just have no energy policy. This is the real disaster. President Bush today is going to announce 5 new but modest proposals to encourage the production and use of domestic energy sources, including nuclear power and cleaner burning coal and diesel. Notice nothing in there about alternatives, nothing in there about CAFE standards, the corporate average fleet efficiency standards. I believe that's what CAFE stands for. In other words, how many miles per gallon do all the cars made by a particular car manufacturer get? Nothing about conservation. Nothing. None of these topics are being raised in this. Why? Well, because we the people are not writing this legislation. It's being written increasingly, well, since the Reagan administration, the explosion of it then, it's being written increasingly by lobbyists. It's being written increasingly by the lawyers for the very corporations that are regulated. Here we have, for example, Bush Greenwatch. We should get up our Bush Greenwatch theme music here. Let's see if that'll play. Ah, there we go. The Bush Greenwatch theme music. Arctic drilling, will not reduce U.S. dependence on foreign oil. Proponents say that drilling in Anwar will reduce America's dependence on imported oil, but the earliest any Anwar oil could reach the lower 48 states would be 10 years. And here's the real kicker. Even 20 years from now, when Anwar is expected to reach peak production, it will only supply 3% of U.S. oil consumption. And even beyond that, where did that go? Maybe it's not in here. But one of the things that I thought was most concerning about this is that given the way this stuff has to get transported, how far away Anwar is from the refineries, and most of the refineries now being in the Texas-Louisiana coast area, you'd have to bring it down the Pacific, through the Panama Canal, and back up. It's just as expensive, more or less, to take it across the Pacific to China. It may well be that the Anwar oil is destined for Asia. And nobody is denying that. I mean, it's an entirely reasonable and plausible possibility, perhaps even a probability, just given the way oil moves. Now, the proponents of drilling in Anwar would say, well, the flip side of that is that oil is fungible. Fungible. It's like silly putty. You know, you squeeze it and what pops in here pops out there, that sort of thing. The world oil supply is fungible. If it goes down here, it comes up there. If it goes up, you know, like that. So if there's not enough over here, we can always get it from over there. And so, therefore, if we start selling oil into Asia, that means that the Asians will be buying that much less oil from Saudi Arabia, which means we'll be able to get more oil from Saudi Arabia, and the effect is the same. Sort of like we're buying our own oil from Saudi Arabia via Asia from Anwar. Now, what is the alternative to this? An increase in automobile fuel efficiency standards, that's CAFE standards, of 3 miles per gallon would save more than 1 million barrels a day. If U.S. standards for replaced tires were upgraded for those new cars, it would save 7 billion a day. Now, you get that? If the U.S. standards for replacement tires were upgraded to be the same as those for the tires on new cars, it would save 7 billion barrels of oil. And guess how much money, or oil, it's ultimately about money, is what it comes down to. That's where I was going with this. But anyhow, guess how much oil is in Anwar, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge? Estimated 7 billion barrels. And how much would we save in the United States if we just upgraded our tire standards to be the same as those for new cars? 7 billion barrels. So why isn't Bush running around saying, we need to upgrade tire standards? If you simply upgrade tire standards so that replacement tires have to meet the same standards as those for new cars, then we won't need the Anwar oil. It'll be the equivalent. Or why isn't he saying, let's do both if there's really an oil crisis? Well, apparently the upgraded tire lobby is not as powerful or wealthy. Or it could be that the Bush family has just never been in the upgraded tire business, so they don't understand it. Nobody, by the way, even in the Bush administration, is suggesting that drilling in Anwar is going to reduce oil prices. It's too little, and it's going to come too late. 5 to 10 years down the road, 3% of the oil. Only 3.5 of those 7 billion barrels are economically recoverable. This means that opening the Arctic Refuge for drilling would only increase global oil reserves by less than 0.7%, meaning essentially no effect on world oil production and prices. Yeah, here we are. Another cost problem is the transportation of crude oil to the lower 48 states. The majority of the refineries are in Texas and that area, meaning the oil would have to be shipped from Alaska down through the Panama Canal. Yeah, that's what I told you. An investment in renewable energy, on the other hand, would produce an explosion of jobs in America. It would birth an entire new industry. Here's an opportunity for a whole new industry to come into being. Studies by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Congressional Research Service predict that 60,000 to 130,000 jobs would be created if the Anwar Refuge, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, let us not forget, they want to call it the oil preserve, it's the National Wildlife Refuge, were opened for drilling. 60,000 to 130,000 jobs. But a TELUS industry report recently said that investment in renewable energy and improved energy efficiency would create 750,000 to 1.3 million new jobs. I remember when Jimmy Carter was president and he said, you know, we're going to be facing a problem. At that time, the United States was importing just a little over 20% of its oil. Not a whole lot. And still it was enough that when the Arabs in the Middle East didn't like what we were doing in supporting Israel in the Six-Day War in 1972, 73, they pulled our oil. They said, that's it. We're not going to sell you any. We're going to boycott you. And Louise and I, it must have been 72, because Louise and I were living in Detroit at the time, and I remember all the stores suddenly, boom, that was it. I mean, the grocery stores and the supermarkets, there was nothing on the shelves. People just wiped them out, picked them clean. And within a few days, we had these long lines at gas pumps. You could only buy gas on odd numbers day, on, let's see, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday if you had odd number license plate, or Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday if you had an even number license plate. There were people cutting into gas lines and getting shot. There was a guy shot about 3 miles from our house. I used to drive by the gas station all the time, where this guy was shot in a gas line because he tried to cut in. Somebody got out and said, that's it, pulled out a gun, bang, blew him away. And that was when we were importing only 20% of our oil. And so Jimmy Carter said, you know, it's not wise for us to be this vulnerable. It's not wise for us to be in a situation where another country can say, that's it, you're out of luck, you can't have any oil. And so we need to become energy independent, independent of Middle Eastern oil. And if we do the things that I'm suggesting, that Jimmy Carter said back in the late 70s, if we do the things that he was suggesting, within 20 years, that would be by the year 2000, we would be energy independent. We would be independent of the energy needs in the Middle East. Cut speed limits down to 55. Turn the thermostat down in your house 2 degrees. Make it fashionable to wear sweaters. You know, using the bully pulpit. Super insulate your house. Offer tax breaks to people who insulate their homes. Offer tax breaks to industries that are starting, that are using solar power, geothermal power, wind power, biomass. Give tax breaks to new houses that are being built using these technologies. Require utilities to take power back into the grid, meters that run backwards if you're developing your own power. It is just all very straightforward. And it birthed an industry. And we could do it again. I mean, unfortunately, Carter's vision was not realized. And it was not realized because Ronald Reagan came into office on the back of all this oil industry money. And his first official act of office, of course, was to remove Jimmy Carter's solar panels from the roof of the White House, fulfilling a campaign pledge to Chevron and ExxonMobil and Texaco and like that. And so here we are. Now, over half of our oil is imported, over a quarter of it from the Middle East. We're in a far worse situation than we were when Nixon was president and when Carter was president, when the oil shocks happened. Far worse situation. And what does this administration want to do about it? $8 billion in welfare for their buddies in the oil industry. Somehow, that just doesn't seem right to me. It just doesn't seem right to me. The officials said the president believes the country needs a diverse supply of energy, including expansion of aggressive nuclear power. Yes, that's going to solve the problem. The problem with nuclear power is you have to use oil to get the uranium out of the ground, get the uranium refined, get the uranium to the nuclear power plants, and then how are you going to dispose of the stuff once it's used? Nuclear power is no solution. It is no solution. It creates a whole other set of problems, as the French are finding out now. How many more Pacific Islands can they find to dump their waste on? People are starting to say, no, thank you. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't give up. No, don't give up. Welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, TomHartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. The correct spelling is T-H-O-M and Hartman with two N's, but however you spell it, we'll get you there. And just click on live chat up at the top of the page. It will take you to our message board. Click on live chat there, and it'll take you into the chat room. And if you have pop-up suppression, you'll have to hold down the control key when you click the register button to get in. But it's very straightforward and absolutely free. And some of the finest minds in the entire planet hanging out in our chat room today. Great to see you all. The White House pushes a flatly false claim about judges. We'll get to that in just a second. I just want to wrap up this thing about oil. This is insane, this policy. It goes beyond insane. This is criminal, this policy. Absolutely criminal. It's wrong. President Bush now is offering to make closed military bases available for new refineries and will ask Congress to provide a risk insurance to the nuclear industry. So we're using too much oil. We're buying it from people around us, well, all around the world. And our answer to this, our solution, is let's figure out ways to get more oil. It's like talking to, say, Rush Limbaugh when he's addicted to Vicodin and saying, you know, you really ought to use a little less of that stuff or take less of that stuff or maybe not use any of that stuff. And he's going, well, I now can get it from my mate. I don't have to buy it online anymore. And, I mean, this is the same thing. These Bushies are acting like addicts. We are addicts. We are addicts to oil. Our society would not run right now without oil. We wouldn't have packaging, we wouldn't have food, we wouldn't have fertilizer, we wouldn't have transportation without oil. All of that can change. And had we followed the track that Jimmy Carter set us on 30 plus years ago, it would be a very different world right now. We would not have these right-wing cranks running the show. And this disaster, this absolute disaster that they're pretending is an energy policy that is actually an $8 billion giveaway to the biggest and greediest industries. I mean, this is just absolutely mind-boggling. The officials said the president believes the country needs a diverse supply of energy, including expansion of aggressive nuclear power. Yeah. And then the Associated Press, J. H. Joseph Hebert, the author of this, Bush Wants Refineries at Ex-Defense Bases, says none of the initiatives was expected to provide any short-term relief from soaring gasoline and oil prices. Well, why would they want to site these things at defense bases? Because the federal government already owns them, and they can say to the local community, you have no say in how we use this defense base. Even though around defense bases, you find a lot of military families living, even though they're not in the military anymore. They bought houses nearby. They settled down. Boy, are they in for a surprise. This is for a surprise. This is a real let's support the troops program, isn't it? Yeah, let's just put a refinery in their backyard. After all, they're over there in Iraq sacrificing themselves for Bush's oil wars. So why not put an oil refinery in their backyard when they come home? Makes perfect sense. The president will outline a proposal to work with local communities to build refineries on closed military sites. Yeah, work with communities. The way he's worked with every other country in the world, it's our way or the highway. You're either with us or you're against us. They note that there has not been a new refinery built in the United States in 3 decades, a statistic that the oil industry and the apologists for high gasoline prices love to repeat like a mantra. Sounds nice. If it were really actually a gas shortage, we would be out of oil right now. If we had a real gas shortage, we'd have a situation where, hey, there's no oil or there's no gasoline in New York City today. There's no gasoline in Los Angeles today. And then, okay, prices are going up. That makes sense. But this is just a rationalization for the highest profits the gasoline industry has ever seen in its 100-year history. Remarkable. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, no, you ain't seen nothing yet. Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. In just a few moments, we're going to be talking with Tim Sparapani of the ACLU. First, we've got a few phone calls here. Let's find out what folks are thinking here. Doug in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Doug, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Well, I've just been listening to you. It's the first time I've actually caught your show, kind of on the road, doing some business, running up some oil. But I've been listening to you. Just a couple things that stick out in my mind. Your talking points, the Democratic talking points that you've been rolling out have a few inconsistencies. One man,
that might have something to do with the fact that they have nothing to do with the Democratic Party. I've been reading from the news.
Yeah, well, same difference.
I see. So if it's the stuff that average Americans want to know about, the things that average Americans care about, it must be Democratic. If it's the things that millionaires and billionaires worry about, then it must be Republican.
Again, talking points there. Let's have a little class envy.
Come on, Doug. You can do better than just call names. You can talk about specifics rather than, talking points.
That's what they are. Anyhow, you point out on one hand that...
this is so sad, Doug.
...with the gasoline shortages, refineries, and how there hasn't been any built in years.
Yeah.
And then, but just prior to that, you were on there complaining that Bush's plan to make available some of these base closures for new refineries is a bad idea. We can't have it both ways. People don't want them in their backyard.
The reality that you're missing, Doug, is that the existing refineries have been massively expanded over the years. There's not a shortage of refinery capacity in the United States. And if we were to start conserving gasoline, we wouldn't need new refineries. You're again talking like a heroin addict. You know, hey, gee, well, you know, it's no problem. We can't get it here. We'll get it over there.
Well, you were just saying yourself that we had a shortage of refineries. Now you're saying we have.
No, I said what I said myself was that the talking point of the oil industry in rationalization for high gasoline prices, and it's just a rationalization because ExxonMobil just had their best year in the history of, they had the largest corporate profit, $30 billion, of any corporation in the history of the planet.
That's good.
And they're sitting on all that money.
My 401k probably includes a little of that, and so does yours.
Well, I'm glad you're so happy about it, Doug. I'm frankly not all that happy about all that money accumulating in the pockets of one big corporation.
And your glorification of Jimmy Carter is just a joke. That guy was the worst president next to FDR that we've ever had. If we had followed his route instead of a...
If we had followed him, Doug, we would have peace in the world. Give me a break. I'm not... This is tragic. Dave in Florida's on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Well, I'm a trucker going across country right now. On an average, I use 100 gallons diesel a day.
Right.
We have a million-plus trucks out here. We can't get the industry to put in what they call auxiliary power units, APUs,
right,
that provide heat and air conditioning during the night and electricity.
Which would dramatically decrease the amount of diesel fuel being used all across the United States and make life easier for you guys.
Saves 8 gallons of fuel per night in a 10-hour rest period, 8 million gallons a day.
Right. They're not doing it because it's not useful for the profits of ExxonMobil to have APUs.
Well, and the other thing we're not doing is one fuel. Instead of having a special fuel in California and a special one in Chicago for pollution, make it one fuel across the country. So if there's a shortage in Texas, I can take the extra in California and ship it to Texas. Where now, because it's a special blend for California, you can't take fuel from California and ship it to Texas.
Right, and what's wrong with having cleaner air in the rest of the United States?
The last thing I would put on is the Trucker magazine. It's called The Trucker.
Yeah.
Had an article on
biodiesel.
Ethanol.
Yeah.
No, on ethanol.
Oh, ethanol.
On
okay.
E10 and E100.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ethanol blend. In the state of Nebraska, they figure they're saving, using the E10, which is 10% ethanol, $5 million a month, and I'm quoting straight out of the article. They make an E10 and an E85, which is 85% ethanol that can be used in American cars. And if we go to the B10 or B20, which is the biodiesel, 20%.
Yeah, these are absolutely necessary changes. Dave, I've got to move along, but I appreciate your call. Thank you so much for sharing that with us and waking people up. The APU, for example, the auxiliary power unit, where truckers are sitting with their engines idling all night to stay warm and have electricity, and if they could just plug in, they wouldn't need to do that. That would be that much less oil being burned. It's just so common sense. Dave, thanks a lot. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. John in Long Island, very quickly, John. I want to get to Tim here with the ACLU. Yeah.
I just want to let you know there's a lot of people moving towards the middle now. I'm seeing a big movement both ways. Yesterday, we just flipped by one of the right stations, and they were talking. They were as angry as we are over some of the issues that are going on right now.
So, oh, yeah. The Bush administration do not represent Republicans. These guys are right-wing extremists. They do not represent the classic Republican values. Dwight Eisenhower and Barry Goldwater are rolling over in their graves. And they certainly are not conservative. They're radicals. John, good point. Thanks a lot. I appreciate that. Tim Sparapani of the ACLU is with us. Tim, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you and your audience.
Thank you. You're a legislative counsel for the ACLU's Washington office.
That's correct.
And we're right there in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C. And you have a take on the Real ID Act. Tell us about what is the Real ID Act?
Oh, this is a really strange piece of legislation, which is about to be enacted into law, probably in the next 3 days. And only in Washington would they do this. The first major provision of this bill is going to repeal much of the recommendations that the 9/11 Commission recommended, in which people fought so hard to get passed last November.
Specifically?
For example, the Commission recommended we improve basic features on driver's licenses so that they were a little bit more tamper-resistant or counterfeit-resistant. Last week, a committee began meeting here in Washington of all the interested parties, the states, the driver's license bureaus, privacy advocates, civil liberties advocates, to make sure that this got done the right way and protected privacy and civil liberties.
Right.
This bill would actually repeal that committee and all the work that they're doing. Even though the federal government has already cashed the check, convened the committee, and the work has begun to improve the standards, this commission is going to repeal...
Why would they do that? Are they doing this in the name of anti-federalism,
in the name of states'
rights?
Yeah, they want to do a bunch of other things. They want to actually create a national ID card, and this committee would stand in the way of doing that. Other provisions.
May I see your papers, please, sir?
Indeed. This is the first major step towards creating a true internal document, which would, you know, every American would have to have.
Now, you said this is set to become law within the next few days. It has passed the House and Senate?
It has passed the House. It was not attached to the Senate Supplemental and Emergency Appropriations Bill, which provides money for the troops and for tsunami aid victims. But the conference committees are meeting even right now, as we speak, to iron out the differences, and it is likely a done deal.
Are they going to attach it to another piece of legislation or just pass it?
It has already been attached to the Emergency Supplemental Appropriations Bill coming out of the House.
Which is going to pass. There's no way that's going to get shot down.
Yeah, there's no way unless
the Republicans kill a filibuster and the Democrats shut everything down.
That's exactly right, but that's not going to happen.
So the bottom line here is what folks should do if they're concerned about having a national ID card like this. What they should be doing right now is calling their member of the Senate, right? Senator?
They need to call their senators right now and insist that this not go through.
And the number for the U.S. Senate, the toll-free number for the United States Senate, you can also reach the House of Representatives and the White House as well through this number. It's the Capitol switchboard. It used to be in the old Senate office building, and it is therefore 1-877-SOB-U, the letter U, S-O-B. If you dial 1-877-SOB-U-S-O-B, you can talk to your senator for free right now and tell them, stop the Real ID Act. Now, what else about the Real ID, Tim, what else about the Real ID Act should concern us?
Well, there are a number of things. For example, for the first time, every time somebody goes to get a new driver's license or a renewal of their driver's license, they're going to have to provide their Social Security number and a verified birth certificate. Most of us can't even find our birth records, much less a verified birth certificate.
Right.
All these documents are going to be put into one database along with a biometric feature, and by that I mean a fingerprint, a retinal scan, perhaps DNA. All that information is going to be put into a single database file, and that file is going to be shared with all of the 3,000-plus DMV offices throughout the United States, as well as every federal agency that wants it, and all of the similar offices, like a DMV office in either Canada or Mexico.
Now, here's the response to this from people like our Republican caller here a few minutes ago.
Sure.
These are, you know, clearly younger people who'd never read 1984. I mean, I don't think that the reading of George Orwell's novel 1984 has been mandated in schools as part of the curriculum of high schools since probably the early 80s. You know, Reagan and his bunch put an end to that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have any of that kind of nonsense. That's our agenda. And they don't get it. They haven't read American history. They don't know the epic battles between Jefferson and Adams over the Alien and Sedition Laws and whether or not Americans really had rights of privacy and rights of free speech and how those things shook out and what they were all about. They just don't get it. And so what they would say to you in response to that is, hey, I haven't committed any crime. I have nothing to worry about. I don't care if the government has my DNA.
Yeah, and that's one position, but I don't think...
How do you respond to that?
Well, here's the response. part of the principles of liberty are that people who have done nothing wrong should be left alone by the government. They shouldn't have to declare their papers. They shouldn't have to identify themselves to anyone if they've done nothing wrong or if there's no reason to suspect that they've done anything wrong.
But these guys are suspicious of everybody, right?
Well,
and that's the whole Bush thing. Be afraid. Be afraid. Be suspicious. And so there might be people out there that we should be suspicious of. And so if we just have to surrender our own privacy in order to be a little safer, isn't that a good trade-off?
Well, it might be if this would actually work. But we all know, and I'm sure you and your listeners have heard recently about all of the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of individual records that have either been stolen or lost by companies that are compiling information on Americans. For example,
right.
ChoicePoint lost 145,000 records that were actually stolen by identity thieves. Bank of America lost 1.2 million records on their customers. And the problem with this is that it allows sophisticated identity thieves, sophisticated criminals, or the terrorists that are trying to hurt the country to assume the identity of people so they can move freely throughout our society.
Here's my bigger concern. My bigger concern than that, Tim,
please,
is that should our government, and this, by the way, is the reason why historically conservatives have taken the position, we will not have a national ID card in the United States. In fact, the main conservative objection to Social Security was that it was giving everybody in America a number. And that number would become a central repository. And that's why the original Social Security legislation, and this was law right up through the 1990s, as I recall, the 1980s anyway, it was against the law to require the Social Security number as identification, as an identifier number.
And it still is.
It still is. Okay. Well, tell that to my health insurance company. But in any case, the point that they would make, that the Barry Goldwater conservatives would make, and frankly, I think the George McGovern liberals would make as well, is that if our government ever becomes oppressive, and here now we have a situation where our government has taken two American citizens and thrown them in jail with no access to lawyers, no access to the courts, no presumption of innocence, and kept them there for years and brags about it, and it may be more than that. They say they're not going to tell us if there's more than two Americans. We have built six concentration camps now, and we have human beings in them. If our government should ever become oppressive, if our government should ever start going into political meetings with the president, for example, and dragging people out because they have no blood for oil bumper stickers on their cars, then that government shouldn't have that level of information and power that they can peer into the lives of every single individual at such a level that should you be perceived by that government as a dissident, as somebody who's with the opposite party, they can use that to punish you or to take you out. Here you have a situation where this International Telecommunications Treaty bunch, which normally industry sends representatives to, the Bush administration vets through the State Department, half a dozen of these people to this meeting down in Central America were just told that they couldn't go. Nokia, a cell phone manufacturer, was told that three of their employees could not go to this meeting because they had donated money to the John Kerry campaign.
Yeah, I can't speculate.
Here we are.
I cannot speculate about why it is that the administration feels they need this information, but I will tell you they are putting together the infrastructure to track Americans. And that's one philosophy.
I think it's because these guys are Stalinists.
I would reject. Well, I won't characterize them. I will just say the facts speak for themselves. They are building the infrastructure to track Americans, and not only Americans, but anyone who travels through the country. Now, there may be some benefits to that if identity theft wasn't such a rampant problem, and if people from Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations weren't sophisticated enough to be able to steal Americans' identities at ease.
And if we didn't have the potential, if our government didn't have the potential, which has always existed ever since 1778, or 1787 when the Constitution was put forward, it's been clear to Americans that the potential has always existed for a democracy to become something other than a democracy.
That's true.
And as long as it has that potential, you know, I side with the conservatives on this and saying we don't want the government, if it has the potential for that kind of abusive power, to have that kind of power.
Yeah, I will say this. This vote, this bill could not come to a vote over the last 2 weeks in the Senate straight up because there was so much internal Republican opposition to the bill. But because it was attached to a bill which is labeled as an emergency appropriations bill to fund the troops in the field,
right,
and the tsunami aid victims, It was hardly debated. This bill has never had a hearing in the House. It's never had a hearing in the Senate. It's never had a floor debate in the House or the Senate.
This is incredible. This is absolutely incredible. It's called the Real ID Act. We were talking with Tim Sparapani of the ACLU's Washington, D.C. office. Tim, it sounds like the only thing people can do right now is call their senators. You have 2 or 3 days, right?
Yeah, I think outrage is the key here. And I think that when people begin to go to get their driver's licenses renewed in a few months and they have to start producing documents they've never had to produce before, average Americans.
Or bend over or whatever. I mean, here, open your mouth. We're going to take a DNA swab. I think that's going to wake up a lot of people. The number for Congress, if you want to call your senator on this, 877-SOB-USOB. That really is the toll-free number for the United States House of Representatives and Senate. Call the Senate. Call your senator. Tim Sparapani with the ACLU. ACLU.org is their website. Tim, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I do appreciate it. It's 10 minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartman program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really
theory, anyway.
Want. You can get it if you really
welcome back, my
want,
friends. What happened to my headphone volume there? That's strange. I must have turned the wrong dial. Welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. And democracy, what an original idea. Janice Rogers Brown has some different notions about democracy. We'll get into that in the next hour. So much happening in the news. We'll have a delay alert coming up. We have a Bush wedding bells on the horizon here story for you from Andy Borowitz. But first, let's go to the telephones. Gary in Alabama on the line. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program. Oh, let me turn your volume up. There you go, Gary.
I enjoyed the last call, or I didn't enjoy it, but anyway, reply to him. You know the thing, when they outlaw guns, only criminals will have guns.
Yes.
Well, when they require ID cards, only the honest will have real ID cards. The rest will all be phony or false.
There you go. And that's my concern. Go ahead, Gary. I'm sorry.
What was the name of that act again?
It's called the Real ID Act.
Okay.
And you can call your United States senators. You have two of them. And you can call them at 877-SOB-USOB.
Okay.
No joke.
Right.
That really is their telephone number.
You're right on the as far as the false. You know, the rest of them will have phony ones, and all our information will be out where everybody can get at it.
Yeah, this is just, in my opinion, the reason that the Bush administration is pushing this is because deep down in their hearts of hearts, they are Stalinists. They believe in single-party rule. They do not want a pluralistic democracy. They do not want dissent. That's why if you show up at one of the Bush Social Security conversations and you happen to have a bumper sticker on your car that says no blood for oil, you will be hauled off. It has happened all over the United States. If you try to protest, you're going to be put in a cage a half mile away. What happened to the First Amendment? It guarantees our right to organize, to gather together, to request a redress of grievance from our own government. They say, no, no, that First Amendment stuff, that's quaint. That's old-fashioned. We don't need that. And these guys wanted to have all the information on every one of us so they can track us down. So they know before you even show up at the event. You walk through the gate and they do the biometric testing. And they're like, oh, this is the guy. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it, Gary. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting. For a change. Time to change our politics, too, eh? 1-877-SOB-USOB. Call your senator now. And tell him not to mess with the filibuster as well. How many more of these can I fit in?
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from behind the good old stainless steel working class microphone. 7 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock Pacific, 11 o'clock Mountain, 12 o'clock Central, and 1 o'clock Eastern. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to be on the program. TomHartman.com, the website if you want to drop into our live chat room or participate on the message boards. Click live chat, it'll take you to the message boards. Click live chat again, it'll take you into the live chat room. Very straightforward. Alec Dubrow is the media coordinator of the International Labor Communications Association, and which is an affiliated institute with the AFL-CIO, represents over 500 union media outlets and 50 associated members. And so Alec is sort of the spider at the middle of the web, as it were, in terms of knowing what's going on with labor around the United States. Back in 1987, Alec, I see you were president of the National Writers Union, which I'm a member of.
Excellent. So, excellent. So pay your dues, Tom.
Well, I was in 87, in fact. For a lot of years, I was. I think I still am. It's been a year or two since I've gotten anything in the mail. Maybe I forgot to renew. I don't know. But I think I'm still a member. Anyway, welcome back.
Good enough. Hi, how are you?
Great. Today or upcoming Workers' Memorial Day. What is Workers' Memorial Day? April 28th, right?
Okay. Well, I'm talking about labor here, and labor is really about how we spend half our waking hours, and for too many people, more than half their waking hours, and who gets to determine it. And if I could just pontificate for a few seconds, frankly, the American workplace is pretty much in this country the last vestige of feudalism, because we permit, we accept arbitrary authority to a degree we wouldn't anywhere else in our lives.
Yeah.
And unions, who I'm associated with, were developed in part as a counterweight to that authority.
Right, to bring democracy to the workplace.
That's right.
A union really is democracy in the workplace. There's no other way to describe it.
Too many corporations believe they're being liberal when they say, we'll listen to any worker. Well, they'll listen to them, but they get to say yes or no in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And unless workers have some power, obviously, that's only half democracy.
Right.
And in the case of the workplace, this idea of feudalism is, you know, it's not, it's largely a matter of dignity, but often, too often, it can be a matter of life and death.
Yeah, as was well portrayed in Charles Dickens' novel, A Christmas Carol, the story of Tiny Tim's struggle for life and death because his employer, his father's employer, Ebenezer Scrooge did not provide health care for the family. And Marley, of course, was gone. But it was a feudal relationship, a lord and a serf, essentially.
Yeah. That's not too surprising in a class-ridden place like Britain in the mid-19th century. But to find it here in the 21st century, that's a little more surprising. So the issue is that when we say life and death, it isn't. It's simply a matter of not having health insurance. It's really about workers who've been killed or injured on the job or have suffered debilitating illnesses as a direct result of their work.
So by talking about Memorial Day, normally our Memorial Days are for soldiers who fell in the field of battle. This is Memorial Day for workers who fell in the field of the workplace.
Exactly. Now, Workers' Memorial Day is an actual event, and it was launched here in the United States. It's accepted as a national holiday in 10 countries, according to the International Labor Organization.
Do you know off the top of your head what those countries are?
No, I can't. I have it listed.
I'd be curious to find out. Are they by and large Western democracies?
They are Western hemispheric. They're Latin American countries, and I believe a few in Europe. They are, in fact, they are not communist dictatorships, if that's what you're...
Yeah, because very often, you know, nations like Cuba will use the rhetoric of
workplace democracy and unions, or China, for example. China,
right.
One of the things that you hear from all the folks who are sending their sweatshop labor over to China is, oh, China requires you to have a union. Well, yes. And in the country of China, there is only one union, and the government runs it. And you must join it. And it ain't a union. I mean, they call it that, but it ain't a union.
Well, yeah. There are also company unions in the United States as well. The outcome is not generally as dire as it is in China, but it can be, particularly for dangerous occupations.
Right.
So anyway, Workers' Memorial Day was kicked off in 1989, and it's this Friday. It's April 28th. It was chosen because it's the anniversary of the establishment of OSHA, of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and it's been 34 years since it was created.
Right.
And you know, the goal of OSHA was to create a safe, quote, a safe and healthful working environment for every American worker. And they set and enforced standards, and they created NIOSH to conduct research and investigations.
The National Institute on Occupational Safety and Health.
Exactly, related organization. Both of which have been under assault for some time, and particularly so in this last administration.
Right.
But we can get to that later. Anyway, for too many people, work is dangerous, and more dangerous than it should be, is the point here. Well, it's true that life itself can be risky, and I don't suppose any of us would want to remove all risk from life. Workplace injuries, diseases, and death are usually the result of calculated cost-benefit decision. And the people who
on the part
make
of the
those
employer.
Decisions... What? I'm sorry?
On the part of the employer. So the employer says, okay, if we have three people die a year, but it's going to cost us $150,000 to replace this machine that keeps falling on people or, you know, cutting their hands off or whatever, and those three people who die a year are only going to cost us $40,000 a year, not $50,000 per person, then it's going to cost us $120,000, but we save $150,000, so our net profit is $30,000, so we don't replace the machine, that kind of thing.
Yes, and it doesn't even need to be that calculated and cold-hearted. It's just a matter of speeding up production or reducing rest time or shaving here and shaving there. And the ultimate result is injury and death, and in which case an employer or anyone seeking to defend that decision can say, well, look, there was driver error involved, there were other factors. Well, there's always other factors. You know, it doesn't... It's occasionally hard to separate these things out, but the truth of the matter is where there are standards, where they're enforced, death and injury goes down. And
right.
that's all there is to it. But part of the problem isn't just the mean old employers. Part of the problem is the public and their recognition of it, or
well,
part
I'd
of
say
the point,
that,
their lack of recognition.
I would say that one of the big problems that we have here, Alec Dubrow of the International Labor Communications Association, our guest, is that our media doesn't report workplace deaths and injuries. I would guess that the average American has no idea what the risks are in the workplace, how those compare with the risks in the home, for example, or the risks of walking through a bad neighborhood, and what the odds are of being injured in the workplace are, and what can happen to people who are injured in the workplace, how they get tossed aside.
Exactly.
Do you have some statistics or information you can share with us?
Oh, absolutely. But just on that point of general recognition, the fact is, of course, this is a worldwide problem. It's certainly not confined to the United States. And unlike terrorism or natural disasters, we tend not to pay attention to it. What I've told people over the years is that if you accumulate 3 or 4 or 100 deaths a day spread out over the country, it's no news. If you get 1,000 in one place, it'll be news for a month. But the numbers themselves are obviously...
And those numbers are?
Yeah, okay. Worldwide, the International Labor Organization estimates 270 million workplace accidents in 2004. In some countries, in some sectors...
That's more than there are workers in the United States by a factor of 2.5.
That's right. And that 2.2 million people continue to die annually from the effects of work, including 22,000 children killed on the job.
Okay, now there's some pretty grim places. I've been in factories in Egypt, for example, where you can see some of the workers are clearly 12 years old. What about the United States?
Okay. The AFL-CIO's Health and Safety Department says that each year more than 60,000 workers die from job injuries and illnesses, and another 4 to 6 million, 4 to 6 million are injured.
60,000 a year die? And how many people were killed in 9/11?
3,000.
60,000 American workers die, and how many are injured?
What they said is 6 million.
6 million.
Okay.
And this is just not reported.
Well, it's not reported in the, you know, part of this, you know, it's a whether a question of whether somebody dies as a result of accumulating the workplace illness or injuries over the years and then dies later on from that.
Right.
So that becomes less of news. The fact is, according to the AFL-CIO again, on an average day, 150 workers lose their lives as a result of workplace injuries. And another 12,000 are injured every day.
Wow.
And, you know, obviously part of it has to do with who the news reading public is, who tend not to be among those who incur the injuries, because these are not so evenly distributed. Mm-hmm. Death and injury rate is much, much higher for immigrant workers who are given the hardest jobs, the most dangerous
right,
jobs.
Right, and more likely to be ignored by the media.
Ignored by the media and ignored by the law and safety.
Yeah.
However, in all this, there is some good news, which is that the death and injury rate has fallen since OSHA came in. The number of workplace injuries in the last century, the 19th century, was so enormous that there's still plenty of researchers trying to calculate it. But since OSHA, what they estimate, since 1970, workplace safety and health conditions have improved, and more than 300,000 workers can now say their lives have been saved by the passage of OSHA. Now, that is significant.
Right.
You know, that is...
Alec, we have about 1 minute left, and
okay.
I'd like to wrap this up. Where can people find more information? ILCA.online.com or .org, is your website?
That's about our group, but if they go to the AFL-CIO's own website, there's information about the Workers' Memorial thing.
Right, AFL-CIO.org. Yeah. By the way, if you could pass along to whoever does the website there at ILCA, that you folks have one of my articles published there, which is great with me, and it has my email address on it. And I'm trying to get my email address scrubbed off the web because it's just I'm getting so swamped with spam.
You're talking to the guy, I'll take it off.
Okay, thanks. I don't mind people knowing my email address. I put it on all my articles, but I do Tom, and then I put parenthesis A-T, close parenthesis, TomHartman.com. Rather than, you know, putting it out there for the spiders. Anyhow, Alec Dubrow is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org, an affiliated institute of the AFL-CIO, represents over 500 union media outlets and 50 associated members. Alec, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I do appreciate it. Keep up the good work.
Okay, it's happy Memorial Day.
Thanks, and you too. It's the Tom Hartman program, the True People's Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Welcome back to our program. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, our Washington, D.C. correspondent. Hey, Ellen.
Going on, there is a hold your feet to the fire group that is meeting through Roger Hedgecock. They're actually doing a radio row here. And,
where is here?
In Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And
why are they doing a radio row?
Well, they're trying to lobby Congress to go with the vigilantes who are, as you know, trying to stop immigration.
Oh, so this is about the what do they call themselves? Minutemen?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And
this is in support
of
them,
group,
presumably.
You know, that group is supporting Roger Hedgecock and a bunch of talk show hosts doing this.
Amazing.
So we were there today, and I mean, one woman, I know you like hard news, but I got to give you a sense. One woman had contacts that, when you look at her contacts, are in the shape of American flags. I mean, you see American flags when you look into her eyes.
She has American flags printed on her contact lenses?
That's right.
That's really... Well, actually, it's kind of great. Well, I mean, that's kind of cool, I think.
You know Adam and Greg from
it's
our
weird.
Operation. Well,
yeah.
they took a picture of it, so we can even email it. You can put it on your website. And I said quite loudly that I thought we ought to have open immigration between Canada and Mexico and the United States. And the woman just went totally nuts, saying, you know, they're not paying my hospital bills, and da-da-da-da. I said, well, who's going to pick your fruit, ma'am? They went totally nuts.
Yeah. Well, you and I are on different sides of this issue, Ellen.
We are.
I have to tell you. Yeah, but which is fine with me. I know a lot of my friends think that, you know, we should have absolutely totally open borders. I believe that countries, as like with communities, the communities should have the rights to protect themselves against external predators like Walmart. And the same way, economically, countries should have the right to protect themselves from economic predators. And that's why I'm opposed to fair trade agreements, or so-called. I'm opposed to free trade agreements, these which open our borders to the corporations. And I'm opposed to absolutely opening our borders to labor.
Well, I'm
believe, not going to try and change your mind.
No,
but,
no, no.
You know, if you want to know.
I believe unions ought to be doing something. But I think that the United States, Mexico, and Canada, like the European Union, are so connected.
Mm-hmm.
That I think we ought to think about sort of a one deal with the three countries, not with every country.
It would be nice. It would be nice if Mexico got its act together. You know, I could see it with Canada, frankly, and in fact, you know, I know businesses in New Hampshire that, you know, bring in Canadian workers all the time, and a lot of Americans who work in Canada. But with Mexico, you've got a country where it's difficult, if not impossible, for many people to get birth control. You've got exploding population. You've got an incredibly corrupt government. You've got basically an oligarchy. And
that's
true. And the consequence of that oligarchy is a lot of unwanted children, an explosion in population, huge massive poverty and disease, and a population ripe for exploitation by multinational corporations. And they're supplying us labor to pick fruit. And I would say, and in fact, I had a guy on the program who was a vintner. He owned a vineyard out in California. And I would say, I'd rather pay an extra 20% for my fruit and know that the people who are picking it are actually paid a decent wage, and those jobs are going to Americans who are unemployed. Who would give anything to have a decent wage?
Well, I don't disagree with that. I just will say one thing. My dear eighth grade social studies teacher, Mr. Dress, pointed out that God did not make a purple line between the United States and Canada.
No, nor between the United States and Mexico, but just because God didn't do it doesn't mean that we can't.
That's true.
I mean,
we'll argue this at another day. I do have one piece of interesting news,
okay,
though. Well, there's several pieces, but the most interesting news, Victoria has been at these hearings and going on the nuclear option and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles Schumer said, look, we're not going to stop Congress, but we are going to bring up the high cost of energy and gasoline, health care, education.
They're going to do what they should be doing.
We don't usually do that in the Senate, but he said, we will not stop.
That's great. That's great. I hope they don't stop, period. I mean, they don't need the filibuster to get them going on this. Well,
that's true.
That's good news, Ellen. Thanks.
More tomorrow.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. And you hang on the line. Louise wanted to talk to you. Hang on. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be right back.
LaborRadio.org.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. The corporate jet, necessity or ultimate executive toy in today's USA Today. Extremism or bust.
The White House pushes flatly false claim about judges in the progress report today. Andy Borowicz, Bush to wed Saudi prince. Huh? Progress too slow, say 9/11 panelists. So much that I want to touch on in this segment. First, however, let's hear what you have to say. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling the Tom Hartman Show.
Yes, good day, Tom. I was listening to what Ellen was saying there when she was quoting Senator Schumer, and I have to agree with you. You know, when I first heard that, I thought to myself, what? Shouldn't she be doing all that anyway?
I'm just a little boggled that a senator would say, we don't normally do that.
Yeah, so you know what he's admitting there implicitly, or explicitly, is that most of the time we don't talk about the real issues. But anyway, let's focus on this so-called nuclear option.
It boggles my mind, too, Rick, that they think that that's a threat. Like, that should be what they normally do. The Republicans aren't, like, out pushing their agenda as a threat to the Democrats. It's what they do. These guys are our representatives. We hired them. It's what they should be doing. Pardon me.
But they're not really working for us. They're working for the oligarchy.
Many of them are. Most of them are. I agree. And we need to change that. And the way that we change that is we insert ourselves into the political process.
Right. And that includes Democrats, too, some of them.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. But getting back to this so-called nuclear option, now, it's my understanding, I just wanted to lay out a few facts here, and then I'll just let you and the rest of the callers, if they want to discuss this, toss it around. But it's my understanding that the filibuster used to be 67 senators. And before that, even one senator could have held it up, so they've actually liberalized
yes.
it.
Yeah, it went from 67 to 60 in 1919 or 1917.
Right, but before that, even a single senator could have held it up. And, of course, the whole idea of the Senate was, you know, the cliche has been it's the saucer that cools the coffee or something. I forget the exact term they use. But anyway, and, of course, as you probably know, before the 19-teens, those folks in the Senate were actually appointed by state legislatures.
That's right. Not always by state legislatures. In some states, they were appointed by the governor. The Constitution says that the Senate shall be appointed by the states in whatever manner they determine they want to do it.
But I guess what I wanted to ask you and the rest of the listeners to maybe call in and get this discussion going is what's really behind this. Now, what I'm hearing, what's really behind it is because I think Mitch McConnell said it yesterday. I was watching a rerun of the Senate business, and he says, well, what we're afraid of here on this side is that you might want to do this to a Supreme Court justice,
yeah,
even a Chief Justice. Well,
this is all about stacking the Supreme Court.
Sure, and Harry Reid made an excellent point. He says, you know, if we can have a filibuster for a four-year appointment, why shouldn't we really scrutinize a lifetime appointment?
Yeah.
I mean, now, can you imagine Scalia or Thomas being appointed Chief Justice? Now, there's only one vote, of course. But, of course, the other thing of it is that Scalia, I don't know how many people remember this, he was confirmed 98 or 99 to nothing, I think.
Yeah, 99 to nothing.
Now, Thomas, of course, was much closer. And I'm just amazed by how the Republicans always accuse the Democrats of playing the race card. Well, I've been hearing about how Janice Brown Rogers is there.
Yep, in fact, that was going to be my next rant. I've got a whole thing.
Well, then I'll hold off on that. But you know what I mean. I mean, they play this race card, Miguel Estrada, this poor Mexican, this Catholic person, this female.
Right.
I mean, all the quota groups that they knock the Democrats for promoting, when it's on their side, all of a sudden it becomes relevant.
Right. If they had a WASP that they absolutely wanted to get in, there was no other way, they'd have him go out and have his arm amputated so they could claim he was an amputee. Yeah, he was handicapped. I mean, it's tragic. It's really and truly tragic. And here we have Bill Frist, absolutely bound and determined to stack the Supreme Court with extremist judges, and the religious extremists think that he wants to do it because he's one of them and because he's concerned about God in the Constitution. There is no God in the Constitution, of course. The word God doesn't appear in the Constitution. The word Bible doesn't appear in the Constitution. And in fact, there is nothing in the Constitution which corresponds with the Ten Commandments. Nothing. Not zero. Zip. Nada. Not even an injunction against murder or robbery, which are the two things that we have at common law that agree with the Ten Commandments. Those are not in the Constitution. That's left to the states. There's nothing in the Constitution that has anything to do with the Ten Commandments. But anyhow, the religious folks think that that's what this is all about, and they're being played for suckers by Bill Frist, because Bill Frist is a corporatist, and what he wants is his people on the Supreme Court who will rule in favor of the corporations. And if they rule in favor of God and against gays and in favor of guns, which is corporations, so be it. That's fine. But he is most concerned with things like liability for his health and his hospital, private hospital corporations, and cutting the insurance costs and passing more of the burdens of corporate taxes onto people and off corporations. That's his agenda. And he knows that if he can stack the Supreme Court, he can roll back the New Deal. He can, yeah, I mean, it was the Supreme Court that back in the 19-teens ruled that unionization in the workplace was illegal, that child labor laws were unconstitutional, minimum wage law was unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court can rule that way again.
Well, I think you're right. I think you've really hit on something here when you talk about the religious right being played for suckers, because these folks that really run the party, as opposed to the people they want to vote for them, you know, you will see, for instance, that even when Ronald Reagan was in there, he didn't even speak directly to the right to life groups.
No, and he didn't go to church on Sundays either. I mean,
and you will see George Bush ban assault. And I'm not saying any of this is bad. In fact, as a liberal, I probably think it's good. And you will see Bush spend money. I mean, because what this is really all about is one thing: lowering taxes on rich people.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who's not particularly politically astute happened to live nearby our local John Birch Society bookstore here in Grand Rapids, and in some ways those folks are more honest than the corporate conservatives. But anyway, he went in there and looked over all their literature, and he says, you know, Rick, he says, what this is really all about is these people just don't want to pay taxes. I says, you know, I says, you're not even that politically astute, but I says, you've hit on it. All this other stuff is, I guess, what they might call boob bait almost. You know,
I have to tell you, Rick, when I was a teenager, I attended a John Birch Society meeting. And in fact, I attended two of them, and in central Michigan.
Really?
And my take on it, looking back on it now with a little more insight than I had at the time, was a friend of mine's father was really into it, and this was when I was going through my Barry Goldwater phase when I was 13 years old, and my take on it was that these were folks who, by and large, were fearful. But at the same time, that there was a strong streak of patriotism in there, that they really believed that they were doing the right thing for their country, but they were scared to death of communism, and they weren't sure exactly why, but they knew that the communists were bad. And Nikita Khrushchev certainly reinforced the stereotype, and, you know, building nuclear weapons and everything else. And of course, Khrushchev was running around Russia pointing to America and saying, look at that, they're building nuclear weapons, they're bad. And so we had both countries scaring their people, scaring the wits out of their people. But in any case, the bottom line is I think that a lot of folks in these citizen movements on the right, on the left, and in the middle are, frankly, more motivated by realistic or egalitarian or real human patriotism, populism is a good one. They're more motivated by those things than are the corporatists, who tend to be the ones who are the heading up the parties and tend to be the elected officials and tend to be the ones who are basically playing these folks for suckers.
Well, sure. When you think about these folks in the corporate boardrooms, you know, in the stereotypical cigar smoking plutocrat, does anybody honestly think these folks are discussing, well, let's see now, what can we do to get prayer back in the schools? What can we do to outlaw? They don't give a...
They don't care. They don't care. They absolutely don't care. But they do say, how can we get these folks to come along with us? How can we keep the John Birch Society on our side? How can we keep the Catholics on our side? How can we get the fundamentalist Protestants on our side? It's an ongoing thing. Rick, I got to move along. Thanks for the call. I appreciate
it.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Chris in Abiquiu, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you. On Bill Frist's fabulous filibuster follies. Say that five times fast.
Yeah, fabulous filibuster follies.
Watch your fricatives, my friend.
There you go.
But the Republicans are a strange animal, aren't they? I mean, they have the House, they have the Senate, they have a majority on the Supreme Court, they have the presidency, and en masse they're saying, well, just to make things fair, let's limit debate.
Yes.
You know, it's a good American idea.
It's Stalinism is what it is. I keep saying this. These guys are Stalinists.
Absolutely.
I haven't written it yet. I've started using the word fascist in my writings on Common Dreams back about 3 years ago, and now it's become popular for people on the left to quote that. In fact, some are even claiming credit for it.
Stalinist is closer.
Yeah, Stalin, absolutely.
Yep.
Yes.
Something that people haven't been bringing up. Have you read the Senate rules?
No.
Well, it's really dry reading, let me tell you.
I can imagine. You're talking about Rule 20?
Pardon?
Are you talking about Rule 20 or all the Senate rules?
Well, I'm talking about specifically now Rule 31, because I went through them recently. Rule 31, which has been there for 214-odd years, categorically states that if a nominee is not confirmed within a certain amount of time, then that nomination has to be dropped and the person has to be renominated. Now, there is no reason to have that rule unless unlimited debate is a given in the institution of the Senate. I mean, otherwise you wouldn't need that rule.
Right.
So that in and of itself,
the rule presumes a filibuster.
The rule presumes unlimited debate, a filibuster. I don't see how they can. Nobody talks about it, but it's in black and white. I just wanted to bring it up in case you wanted to look at it sometime.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure enough, you have a good day, man.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate the call. That's interesting. Rule 31. I'll have to check that out. Alice in Northern California is on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Yeah. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Alice.
I believe that much of America is better informed because you are on the air.
Well, bless you, Alice. Thank you.
Yeah. Our government has been stolen right out from under us. That certainly was clear on your program yesterday.
Yeah, with the voting machine guy. Have you in your 91 years ever seen anything like this?
never. Never.
Yeah, it is absolutely shocking to me. And what's even more shocking to me is how compliant the media are, corporate media, the big corporate media, how they just roll over, they just go along with it. Yeah, no problem. Well, yeah.
They don't want to get their hands dirty.
Yeah, or their hands are already dirty.
Yeah, that's right. Do you think the people could sue to get rid of the voting machines?
Well, the fellow we had on the program yesterday is doing just that. He's sued Sequoia Voting Systems in the state of Washington over the fact that he feels that their contract with the state, which requires that the state collude with them to keep secret any problems their machines have, is a violation of the law. And I think that's great.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, use the beast to beat the beast. Use the lawsuit to take back our vote. I think it's a really good idea. Alice, thank you for the call.
Yeah, keep up the good work.
Thanks, Alice. You too. Yeah. Keep raising rabble as they are being
okay.
A rabble rouser. I appreciate it. Great to hear from
you.
Thanks, Alice. 15 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman program. The White House pushes flatly false claim about judges. This is a headline in today's progress report from the Center for American Progress. Speaking on Air Force One yesterday, White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan said, and I quote, "What has happened in the Senate is unprecedented. There has not been a situation like this where members of one party have blocked nominees from even receiving an up or down vote on the floor," end quote. Now, you'll recall, if you noticed Justice Sunday, Bill Frist said the same thing, Chuck Colson said the same thing, blah, 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 and all the right-wing ministers up there were saying the same thing. Excuse me, conservative. I'm reluctant to call them Christians. As a Christian, I am reluctant to call them Christians. In fact, but let's get back to the real truth here. Scotty McClellan, could he be Jeff Gannon's special friend in the White House? What do you think? You think, Louise? Yeah, maybe not. Who knows? Anyhow, Scotty McClellan, I'm just so curious to know who Jeff Gannon's special friend in the White House is. Who was that person that he was visiting in the White House on all those days when there were no press briefings? Anyhow, Scotty McClellan said, "What has happened in this Senate is unprecedented. There has not been a situation like this where members of one party have blocked nominees from even receiving an up or down vote on the floor." End quote. In fact, notes the Center for American Progress, there have been many situations like this. In the late 1990s, more than 50 Clinton nominees were not even granted a hearing by the GOP-led Judiciary Committee. Not even granted a hearing. Instead of being filibustered on the floor of the Senate, they were filibustered in committee. Overall, quote, 35% of Clinton's appeals court nominees were blocked without a vote while the GOP controlled the Senate from 1995 to 2000. 35%. A little over a third of all of Clinton's judicial nominees were blocked by the Republicans while the Republicans controlled the Senate, 95 to 2000, after the disastrous election of 94, when Clinton's DLC policies, his let's turn the Democratic Party into Republican light policies, lost the Senate to the Republicans. People saying, well, should I vote for the phony Republican calling himself a Democrat, or shall I vote for the real Republican? I think I'll vote for the real Republican. Makes sense to me. In contrast, Congress has approved more than 95% of President Bush's judicial nominees. Oh, but it's unprecedented, says Scotty. Liar. This has never happened before, says Bill Frist. Liar.
It's not an easy word to use, you know, when you're talking about a member of our government. It's a tragedy that it has to be used. One of the reasons why we need the filibuster, Janice Rogers Brown. This is a woman. They're going to play the race card on her. They want her to be the next Clarence Thomas because she's black. She said, just on Sunday, she gave a speech. She said, people of faith are embroiled in a war against secular humanists who threaten to divorce America from its religious roots. I'm quoting Janice Rogers Brown. She said, it here seems to have been no time since the Civil War that this country was so bitterly divided. It's not a shooting war, but it is a war. She added, these are perilous times for people of faith in the sense that it will cost you something if you are a person of faith who stands up for what you believe in and say those things out loud. But the bottom line is, people are not objecting to Janice Rogers Brown because of her faith. People are objecting to her because of her actions. When she was on the California Supreme Court, Larry Craig praised her for her golden eloquence, speaking about basic rights, but a report by the People of the American Way, the NAACP, says it's a little different. I'll fill you in right after this break. What's the real story on Janice Rogers Brown? It is frightening, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Attention.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one.
Oh, why me, George?
Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run. Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
Oh, is that the end of it? A great bumper. Jim Turr's work from BlueCanyonSatire.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 4.5 minutes before the hour. We were talking about Janice Rogers Brown. Janice Rogers Brown. Now, Ann Coulter, in an article posted on townhall.com, this is from a year or so ago, said, the mainstream is located in France. Liberals are hysterical about Janice Brown, principally because she is black. As for the New York Times, Coulter says the reporters who cover judicial nominations for the paper are, quote, a bunch of racist Southern election supervisors out of retirement who believe that Janice Brown should be the maid and Miguel Estrada the pool boy, end quote. Well, let's find out what Janice Brown actually thinks. Now, get this. Get this. This is absolutely incredible. What Janice Brown actually has to say. And I quote, the New Deal inoculated the federal Constitution with a kind of underground collectivist mentality, she said. The Constitution itself was transmuted into a significantly different document in 1937. That year marks the triumph of our own socialist revolution. She thinks Social Security is socialism. Brown on government. Where government moves in, community retreats, civil society disintegrates, and our ability to control our own destiny atrophies. Wait a minute. She's mixing up communism with American democracy. The result, she says, is families under siege, war in the streets, unapologetic expropriation of property, the precipitous decline in the rule of law, the rapid rise of corruption, the loss of civility, and the triumph of deceit. Therefore, get rid of government and all those problems are solved, says Janice Rogers Brown. Well, that last sentence I added, but it certainly implied. She's attacked the U.S. Supreme Court ruling U.S. versus Caroline Products, which was the ruling that said that labor and environmental standards are justified. The New York Times characterized her record as, quote, a war on mainstream legal values that most Americans hold dear. This is who they're going to filibuster over. This is all about returning us to the 19th century, my friends. Turn the power back into the hands of the robber barons. The people? The people? No, robber barons. We can't let this happen. 1-877-SOB-USOB is the telephone number for your members of the United States Senate. Call them now.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to get into the chat room. And somebody was popping up private messages to me. I just have to delete those as soon as they come up. Otherwise, I can't see the call screening software. So if you sent me a message, I didn't get it. And if it's really important, you can send it to me in email. Or during the breaks, I try to read the chat room, although during this break, it was pretty busy. I didn't have an opportunity to get in there. The screen is right in front of me. The Senate, by 200 years of tradition, has had the filibuster. And as a caller in the last hour pointed out, I believe it was Chris in Abiquiu pointed out, rule number 31 of the Senate rules, which goes all the way back to the founding of the Senate, strongly implies that by saying that if a nominee is brought forward and is not acted on with a certain period of time, that nominee is automatically dumped, implies that the filibuster was active at that time. It used to be any one senator could shut down the Senate. Watch the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Then in the 19-teens, they changed it so it took 67 senators. Well, actually, before that, back in the 19th century, they changed it so it took 67 senators. Back in the 19-teens, I think it was 1917, perhaps 1919, they changed it so it took 60 senators to break a filibuster. And now Frist wants to change it so it takes 50 senators to break a filibuster, to stop unlimited debate, to stop discussion, to say, okay, enough talk, let's vote. The Senate is supposed to be a deliberative body. Well, some folks down at Princeton are doing something symbolic and I think media-worthy about this, trying to highlight this issue. And good on them. Joshua Weitz is with us. He's a Princeton University alumni. Hey, Joshua.
Hi there, Tom.
And tell us what's going on at Princeton.
Sure. Well, we heard about this event, which I'm sure you know, Justice Sunday, which happened this past Sunday.
I watched it.
Yeah, well, I think it was only on closed circuit.
No, it was actually, I watched it here in Portland, Oregon on a local TV station.
Yeah, so we heard about it, especially since Senator Frist is also a Princeton University alum. He's class of 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And very prominently on campus, there's a Frist Campus Center. And so a lot of us here thought, you know, this just kind of goes against some basic principles we think, specifically about the independent judiciary. And we thought, you know, even if they're not going to necessarily start the filibustering or the nuclear option yet, we wanted to bring some attention, not only at the national scale, which we really didn't think we'd get, but really just to the student population. And as you know, often university students are somewhat removed, especially in their ivory tower environments, with finals coming up, etc. So we wanted to bring this issue, which has relevance both to the national scale and also as a major alum and a major donor to the university.
So basically embarrass him in his home turf.
Well, I'm not sure if we want to embarrass anyone, at least not as a direct cause or intent, but certainly we want to bring to the attention this sort of disconnect between someone who's supposedly, you know, this doctor, he's supposed to be well-respected, but on the other hand, we're kind of seemingly going about a means to sort of veer off from an independent judiciary and almost, you know, have this tendency to kind of let the churches decide what it means to have a rule of law.
Yeah, I mean, let's tell the truth. Bill Frist is a thug.
Well, you said it, not me.
He's a thug. He's
I certainly think he's deceptive and disingenuous, and I think there's some. I have some very substantive issues, and I think we've been trying to do. So let me just tell you, we've been talking now for over 25 hours, almost 26 now, maybe 27. I've lost count. So we've gone overnight through the rain. We've stood up right there on the Frist Campus Center steps. Right in front of it, we've had a number of...
You're doing an old-fashioned filibuster.
Oh, yeah, we're just going for it. We've got people reading the phone book. We've got people reading the Constitution. We've had people reading the bios. I mean, our intent also is to educate, to let people know that these nominees are radical. I mean, really, really, really radical. This isn't about Democrats trying to stonewall a few reasonable nominees. This is about fringe elements who should not be lifetime appointments to the courts.
Yeah, and in fact, during the Clinton administration, 35% of Bill Clinton's nominees for judicial positions were shot down by the GOP. Most of them never made it out of committee, so there didn't need to be a filibuster because they filibustered them in committee. But 35% of them were shot down. Only, what would that be, 65% passed? Am I doing my math right?
No, like I 65%? Think that's
95%.
I'm trained as a physicist, so I can definitely tell you that 35 plus 65.
Right, okay, so 95% of the nominees that Bush has set up have passed.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, what happened in the Clinton administration was done behind closed doors. And this, you know, to the Democrats' credit, they brought this out into the public arena. They made this a public issue because these are lifetime appointments. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, these judicial appointments aren't supposed to be reflective of the tyranny of the majority, but rather, you know, the will of, you know, of basically collaboration and compromise. And I think we need to have reasonable justices there. And so we hope to continue to highlight this issue, continue to talk. We're hoping to attract perhaps some more prominent members either of the university community or in Congress itself. So we'll see how that goes. But we're students and staff and graduate students are just talking, you know, highlighting the issue. We read My Pet Goat, which I think everyone appreciated.
It's good for 7 minutes, right?
Well, it didn't take us that long. We really, you know, it's only okay. Well, we didn't have the pictures, so, you know,
yeah.
We didn't do the show and tell. We've read, you know, John Stewart's Democracy in America. You know, we've been reading a whole. We had a poetry half hour. I mean, the sun was out. We wanted to make sure that you know, really people were getting the full experience.
May I recommend George Orwell's 1984 and Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here?
Well, you know, we have a big box. The box is full of filibuster materials.
Uh-huh.
And so, if anyone's listening out there who's at Princeton, bring it over to the box and we'll read it.
At the Frist Center at Princeton University.
At the Frist Campus Center on the North Steps at Princeton University.
That's great, Joshua. Is there a website for what you're doing?
Yeah, so we have a website. I wanted to tell you, we're doing some live blogging. We're even hoping to get a live webcam. That's a little more technically difficult because it's been raining and we're hoping, you know, not to electrocute ourselves in the process. So
yeah.
The website is progrev, progrev,
blogspot.com,
and that's the blog of the Progressive Review. We've also gotten highlighted on Talking Points Memo, so people know that, talkingpointsmemo.com. And also, we got picked up in CNN's The Morning Grind.
That's great. That's absolutely great. Joshua Weitz, Princeton University alum, and thanks so much for the great work that you're doing. Just real quickly, what sort of response, by the way, are you getting from campus authorities?
Well, at the beginning, we had a bit of a difficult response. They shut us down for around half an hour, but I think it was really more of a miscommunication, and it was quickly resolved, and we were back up and running. I mean, you know, our intent is not, you know, we're not breaking windows, we're not obstructing anything, we're just talking.
Right, you're not doing a true filibuster in that you're not shutting down any process. You're just doing the square in London is. Trafalgar Square sort of thing.
Square, and we're really, it's the spirit of the filibuster. Obviously, you know, students aren't on the Senate floor. We're not going to enact or stop a cloture movement.
Right, and so you're not keeping people from moving in and out of the building.
Exactly, but we are attracting a lot of people. We've got a lot of support. I mean, last night at around 12 o'clock, we weren't sure if we were going to go on, and some students just showed up. And they said, you know, we want to do it. We're going to be here all night.
That's
and
great.
They were.
So
it's
that
really,
is so cool.
It's really been fantastic.
That's great. Well, Joshua, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
That's just wonderful. Thanks a lot for being with us today. And if you want to learn more about that, as I said, Joshua gave you the URLs there. Go check them out. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Logan in New York City's on the line. Hey, Logan.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make the point that I think the basic message that has to get out there is that the Bush administration's policies aren't very Christian. And I think that this alliance between, you know, these hard right neocons and these hard right Christians is ultimately a false alliance. And I think that you could probably make the point to either group.
They are not Christian and they are not moral, by the way.
Of course. I mean, each group is, they're aligned with each other. These right, you know, right-wing Christians, and then on the other side you have the right cons. But ultimately, they don't agree.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, I think that the best strategy would be to talk to each group more on the religious side and be really explain why, you know, their model is not conforming to any kind of religious model.
Yeah, I think it's like the, what is it, the Hillsborough Baptist Church or whatever it is, Reverend Fred, that there are folks who are just afraid. They're afraid the gays are going to get them. They're afraid that society is going to change. They're afraid that they may have to, the men among them are afraid that they might have to give up absolute control over their wives, and that their wives could actually have a life. They're afraid.
They divide us, so, I mean, we should divide them on some level.
Their fear is driving them. And we should point out to them, if they really want to know what the Bush administration is not doing that should be done from a Christian point of view, they should read the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 25. It's just that simple. Jesus was pretty unambiguous about it. Pardon?
Maybe you could have a guest on that sort of is on that side of things.
Although I can talk about those topics just as well. The problem is that then you get into a rant where somebody tunes in and they think they're listening to Christian radio. it is important for the Christians among us and any people of faith to realize that what Jesus was preaching is not what these guys, what Frist and his friends are talking about. It's not what the Bush administration is doing. What Jesus was preaching was a care for the poor, feed the hungry, care for the sick, visit those in prison. And we have the largest prison population in the world, both numerically and on a per capita basis. Visit those in prison, take care of the homeless, give them a home, provide people with opportunity, and that riches is not only not the way to get into heaven, in fact, it makes it more difficult to get into heaven. That's the stuff that Jesus was teaching. The Bush administration is doing the exact opposite. Jesus never talked about gays, he never talked about divorce, he never talked about abortion, he never talked about gay marriage, he never talked about marriage, period. I mean, Paul once said, well, a person who's going to be a deacon of the church should have one wife. Because back then you could have as many as you wanted, you know, Jesus didn't weigh in on these issues. So where the Christians, and speaking as one myself, where the Christians, these people who call themselves Christians are going wrong is they're not reading the Bible. They're not paying attention to the guy who started, who is the founder of their own religion. And I just wish they would. I really, really, truly wish they would. And enough of that, because, as I said, I don't want this to sound like we're doing Pat Robertson imitations here. Logan, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Speaking of gay marriage, Andy Borowitz, the Borowitz Report. Bush to wed Saudi prince. Impending nuptials. Nuptials? Nuptials alter president's gay marriage stance in a stunning development, writes Andy Borowitz and BorowitzReport.com. A stunning development that could alter both the politics of oil in the Middle East and the politics of gay marriage in the United States. President George W. Bush and Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah announced today that they would wed this June. Tongues began wagging after President Bush greeted the Saudi prince at his Crawford, Texas ranch today with a passionate hug and a kiss. This, of course, was yesterday, igniting rumors that the two men were more than just good friends. I wonder who Guckert was visiting when he went to the White House all those times. Former Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry, who was accused of being overly affectionate in public with his then-running mate, Senator John Edwards, while on the 2004 campaign trail, was one of the first to notice the steamy display between Mr. Bush and Prince Abdullah. Kerry said, "John and I looked pretty gay, I'll admit, but not as gay as these two. I was like, get a room." The announcement that Mr. Bush was set for a trip to the altar with a Saudi prince immediately raised the ire of gay marriage foes, who saw the president's decision as a cruel betrayal. Hundreds of protesters appeared outside the Crawford Ranch moments after the announcement, carrying signs that read, "No love for oil." While Bush acknowledged that his decision was a U-turn, he said, "When a Saudi billionaire asks you to marry him, you have to say yes." Yes. 20 minutes past the hour. 7.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes, coming up on 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Coach Glenn in our chat room. Do you really mean it? He says, where did it go? It's scrolling now. He says they have a sign on the border. Aha, they have a motto. We're ignorant and proud of it. Coach Glenn lives in Oklahoma, I believe. I'm pretty sure. Tulsa. And he says there's a sign on the border that says, welcome to Oklahoma. Set your watch back 50 years. Oklahoma maps show the earth as flat. Come on. Glenn, really? I suspect you're being facetious, Glenn. Interesting conversations in our chat room today. If you want to drop in there, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you over there. Well, speaking of filibusters and Janice Rogers Brown, all the while, the 9/11 panel, here you have the Republican, Mr. Keene, Thomas Keene, Tom Keene, the Republican chairman of the 9/11 commission, saying, you guys aren't doing what we said to do. You guys aren't protecting the homeland. When are you going to start protecting the country? This is the Republican chairman of the 9/11 commission. Why are you running around talking about Social Security and all this other stuff instead of doing what needs to be done? Well, he's not saying that. I'm saying that. But he's saying, you're not helping us. In fact, a huge headline in today's USA Today, front page, big cap, progress too slow, say 9/11 panelists. Investigation leaders, major needs unmet. Could it be that the reason for that is because the Bush administration doesn't have as its first priority securing the homeland, but rather as its first priority setting up military bases to be oil refineries so that they can have another government giveaway of land? The government, you'll remember, gave away hundreds of millions of acres of land to the railroads back in the 19th century, and now they're fixing to do it to the oil companies in the 20th century. Yes, indeed. In the meantime here, 9/11 Commission, they say Congress should be reorganized. Did you know that the intelligence committees have no real power because they don't control agencies' budgets? Well, that's what Mimi Hall informed us about in today's USA Today. Promoting American values in the Muslim world. That was one of the goals. The 9/11 Commission said we need to do this. We haven't done it. Keene said the United States is perceived in the Middle East as a military enforcer. This from the Republican chairman of the 9/11 Commission, quote, we cannot continue to be the man in the tank, and that's our image in the Arab world. Well, maybe that's what we are. I mean, maybe they're starting to figure out that we're just there to protect the interests of the multinational oil companies. Why else would we not be engaging in programs for conservation? Could it be that the oil companies and the Bush administration have had as their greatest blessing, as the best thing that could have happened to them, the 9/11 attacks? That when Bush made the joke about how he hit the trifecta on 9/11, he was dead serious. It's no joke. Could it be? And could that be why they're not doing anything to protect us from another attack? Because they know if we had another attack, that would give them the excuse to completely shut down our civil liberties, completely take over the United States, turn this into a total fascist oligarchy ruled by a small number of wealthy families and multinational corporations. It would be the end of the American experiment. Could it be that the Bush administration thinks that's just fine? Could it be that George W. Bush himself might be the kind of guy who would say, if things were a dictatorship, they'd be a whole lot easier, especially if I was the dictator. You remember that? Could it be that that's what's up? I mean, what's going on here? Why have they not appointed a civil liberties board? Tom Keene is running around saying, hey, we suggested in the 9/11 report that you appoint a civil liberties board. There is none. How about making more radio frequencies available to police, firefighters, and other responders so they can talk to each other during emergencies? This is a techie thing. Take some engineer from some radio station someplace and give them a decent salary in 6 months. They'll fix the problem. Why do these guys, it's been how many, 3 years now? Why do they not want the problem solved? Why are they ignoring the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission? Why? While they're going hell-bent for leather to shut down Social Security and to secure the world's oil supplies. Why? 29 minutes past the hour.
This is
is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
So you spin to the right, then spin to the right, then spin to the right again.
Only to the right?
Then you spin clockwise, spin to the starboard, spin to the right, and then...
Only to the right?
You move a little bit abrupter. You're our nation's finest interrupter.
Is this Fox News?
Yours is the last word and first word. All the words in between and a rude outburst
word. Oh, I know who it is. It's Bill O'Reilly.
Shut up.
There you go.
I put the bull in bully.
Oh, really?
No,
O'Reilly. Hey, welcome back. Welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Anya Shiffrin is with us. Anya wrote a great piece in Mother Jones magazine. She's the co-director of the International Media and Communications Program, adjunct professor at Columbia University, and a writer for Mother Jones. And Anya, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you here. Tell us the story. Tell our listeners the story that you wrote about in Mother Jones. I don't want to set it up beyond that and just let
sure.
you do it.
Well, it begins actually with my cleaning lady, Maria Mata, who came to this country from Mexico when she was 5 years old. And just about the time she was starting to work for me, before I knew her well enough to ask me for help, it turned out that she needed furniture, and she went to a store called Rent-A-Center, and she bought, Thanksgiving was coming, and she wanted some place to sit in her house. She has three kids and lives with her mother. And she saw a chair and a love seat on sale, and they told her that she could put $300 down and pay $300 for the next 2 months total, and that she would then own the sofa and the chair.
$600, and that's a
total.
Reasonable retail price for this furniture.
You know, not necessarily. They do overcharge, for sure.
Yeah.
But what happened to Maria was that 2 years later, she was still paying $100 a month for the furniture. And she told me the story, and I was pretty horrified, and I called the Better Business Bureau and the Department of Consumer Affairs and started doing some research, and I found out that the company she'd bought it from was a huge company. It turns out that the rent-to-own industry is a $6 billion industry, and they're the market leader. They had $183 million of sales $183 million of profit last year and $2 billion of sales.
Wow.
And it's a well-known racket all over the country. And I got so upset that I assigned my students in my journalism class. This is the class project, so we spent the fall researching the company and finding out about them, and the end result was the story that's in Mother Jones this month.
Yeah, and how do they get away with this?
Well, unfortunately, what happened was there's two things that they do. One is that they say that they're renting furniture, not selling it, so they get around a lot of the usury laws that cap interest rates in many states.
But didn't she enter into an agreement that she thought was a purchase agreement?
Absolutely. And
don't they advertise themselves as rent-to-own?
Yes, and 70 studies have found that 70% of their customers do end up buying the furniture. So to say they're renting is ridiculous. Most people are buying.
So they're selling with extremely high interest rates?
Yep, exactly. They're overcharging like crazy. And in the 80s, they hired a lot of lobbyists, and they rolled back and consumer protection laws in all but four states, and they're still giving money to the rent-to-own industry's political action group in order to keep funding rollbacks. They want to see the laws rolled back in the few states that still have laws.
400% interest rates is in the subhead of your article.
Higher.
And that's annually.
Yeah, that's right, and sometimes it's even higher.
So if I borrow $100, I pay $400 a year on it?
Mm-hmm.
Or $500 a year, to pay it back.
And most of the furniture is used and isn't very good. You know, I saw a refrigerator on sale there. Everything's clearly labeled. And I went to one of the branches in New York. They always target poor neighborhoods. So there's one on Cherry Street right next to a huge housing project on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And I found a fridge there that on the spot was, they were selling it for $660. If you paid over 66 weeks, it was $1,319. And I found on the Sears website a brand new one for $570. So why anybody would want to pay $660 for a used fridge when they could get a new one for $570?
Well, they'd want to pay it because they don't have $600. They'd
that's
want to
right.
pay it because they could pay $100 down and $100 a month forever because that's all they have. They have no equity. They have no access to cash. So this is basically an industry that feeds off of the fact that we have a nation where the fastest growing economic sector in our nation is the working poor.
That's right.
Those who are just wiped out, poverty wiped out.
Yeah.
What can be done about this, Anya Shiffrin?
Well, it's basically predatory lending. So I think it's really important to try to get our congressmen to pass laws against it.
But the bankruptcy bill, pardon my interrupting you, but this bankruptcy bill that just came through the Senate and the House, mm-hmm.
and was signed into law by George W. last week.
Yeah.
I believe it was Schumer, one of the senators, proposed an amendment to this bankruptcy bill that would have put a cap, I believe it was 30%, is my recollection, that would have essentially restored the usury laws that were taken down during the Nixon administration when interest rates were pushing 20, 22, 23%. And at least establish a cap of 30%, which in and of itself is outrageous. Up until the 70s, from essentially the founding of this country until the 70s, usury was considered anything over 10%, the exploitation of credit, of people's credit. And he put forward this thing saying, well, let's just cap credit at 30%. And the Republicans, 100% of the Republicans in the Senate said no. Now, how do you think that you can get something like, you know, abusive lending practices passed by the United States Senate or the House, for that matter, when 100% of the Republicans who control a majority in both of those bodies vote against just a simple amendment to a bankruptcy law that says that credit card companies and other lenders can't charge more than 30% a year?
That's appalling. Well, what has been happening is there have been a lot of lawsuits, and they've paid out over $260 million in settlements in just a few states. There's also a class action lawsuit right now in New York City, and unfortunately...
Now, that's going to be illegal soon.
Yeah.
Pardon my interrupting you again, but now class action lawsuits have to go through federal courts. You can't have one at the state level.
Well, what happened in this case was that in 2003, the Bronx Supreme Court ruled against the plaintiff, this Tabitha Cologne, and they ruled against her claim that there were hidden interest rates on the goods that they rent and sell.
Right.
And so now what they're having to prove in New York is deceptive sales practices, which is what happened to Maria Mata, my cleaning lady. She did read the contract. Most of the people that buy from Rent-A-Center, studies have found that they have a high school education or less, and so obviously they're often not reading the contracts or able to understand them. Maria did read the contract and said to them, wait a minute, why does it say here that I'm going to have to pay $1,800 or $2,000 for the chair and the love seat? And they said to her, it doesn't apply to you. So in New York, they're trying to show deceptive sales practices on the part of the Rent-A-Center employees. Their debt collection is also really nasty. They come to people's houses. They leave threatening phone messages. I spoke to one person in Albany who said that they actually broke down the doorway to his house.
And wow.
So that's a problem, too.
Because they're preying on the poor. They figure they can just get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
This is horrific. Anya, what can people do about this?
Well, I think the first thing is to just boycott these stores.
Well, I suspect most people who are listening to this program don't use these stores to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, you're asking people to boycott these stores who, in many cases, don't have the means to do anything else. I mean, it's like saying boycott Walmart to somebody who earns $5 an hour.
Well,
I can't say that to them, you know?
I actually think that Maria would have been better off just going to Salvation Army and buying a used couch.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
In fact, I mean, there are other ways to get cheap furniture.
Yeah.
Not that this is cheap. And I do think keeping the pressure up on congressmen and making complaints to the Better Business Bureau and things like that would help a little bit.
It seems to me that perhaps the most useful thing people could do right now is raise awareness of this as a real issue.
Yeah.
And they could do that by writing letters to the editor of their newspaper referencing the article in Mother Jones, the article that Anya Shiffrin wrote, who's with us today. They could do that by investigating their local, just dropping in, not investigating, just drop in and check out your local Rent-A-Center or similar place. There's other companies that do the same thing with different names. And just, you know, be a customer. Check it out. Find out, you know, what folks in these economic situations are dealing with, and then write about it. Talk about it. Call talk radio shows. You know, get the word out. And then, of course, call 1-877-SOB-USOB, which is the toll-free number for the House of Representatives and the Senate, and let your congressman or member of Congress and your senator know that you think this is wrong, that there should be laws to prevent this. And at the state level, contacting your state elected officials, because clearly the states have had in the past the power to prevent this, and four states still do. And by the way, Anya, that really is the phone number for Congress, the toll-free number.
Good.
It's the old Senate office building number. So it's 877-SOB, the letter U, S-O-B. And I give that to everybody. Please call your member of Congress for free. Anya, how can people pass this word along? I mean, the Mother Jones website, unless you're a subscriber, you can't get to this article. Is there a blog? Is there more information someplace? Is there a national group that's working on this? Is there an anti-poverty group that's dealing with these issues?
Yeah, well, PERG.org, which has been working on this, and they've been doing a lot of lobbying, and they have information on their website as well.
This is the Public Interest Research Group, the one that was founded by Ralph Nader way back when.
That's right. They're still fighting this, and they're doing a good job. Yeah.
Okay, PIRG.org. Any other websites you recommend in addition to MotherJones.com? Yeah.
Yeah, there's an interesting article about Rent-A-Center on Multinational Monitor.
Uh-huh.
And if you just type in Rent-A-Center and lawsuit, you'll find a lot of the stories that have been out there.
Great. Anya Shiffrin, thanks so much for being with us today, Anya.
Thank you.
Anya is the co-director of the International Media and Communications Program, adjunct professor at Columbia University, and a writer for Mother Jones Magazine. Well
Thank
done.
You very much.
Keep up the great work and keep spreading the good word.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Anya. Bye now. 16 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Alan in Indiana on the line. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Yes, I was going to tell you about a website called AmericanRhetoric.com, and on that site you can download famous speeches, and one of the speeches is called Crisis in Confidence.
Crisis in Confidence on AmericanRhetoric.com, okay.
And it's by the speech is by then-President Jimmy Carter, and he talks about the importance of getting away from Saudi Arabian oil, and also he says that he wants to cut our oil use in half by the end of the 80s, and he says this in the 70s.
Wow. I will have to get that. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's AmericanRhetoric.com.
Say it again.
And there's a lot of good speeches on there.
Okay, I thought you said American Rhetoric, RHETORIC.COM, right?
That's right.
And it's the Crisis of Confidence speech by Jimmy Carter.
That's correct.
I will track it down, and we will share it with our listeners. Thank you so much, Alan. I appreciate the call. I love it when my listeners know more than I do and they pass it along and they share it with me. Hey, Kate in Humboldt County is with us. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Tom. I wasn't able to listen to the last hour, but it sounds like what I have to say is just a good follow-on to the last caller. A great bellwether of the tide changing against Bush, and that is that I heard Paul Harvey say today, these are his exact words, had we put into alternative energy what we've put into Iraq, energy independence would now be a done deal.
Wow.
That was Paul Harvey.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. And Paul Harvey's a right-wing crank.
I know, but, you know,
I mean, I say that affectionately.
Exactly.
You know, he's kind of our national right-wing crank, but he is a right-wing crank.
Exactly.
That's incredible.
So those were his exact words. Had we put into alternative energy what we've put into Iraq, energy independence would now be a done deal.
Yeah. Well, and he's right.
Absolutely.
He's absolutely right. Kate, thanks a lot
Thank
for the call,
you,
and thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. My goodness. Bill Frist. I just want to get back to this just for a moment. Bill Frist and Harry Reid just engaged, whether you noticed it or not, in the media, by and large, probably didn't tell you about this, probably didn't portray this the way I'm going to portray it, but this is what I think really happened. Bill Frist and Harry Reid just engaged in a game of political chicken. I don't know how else to characterize it. Frist comes out and he says, okay, we've got to, because these Democrats are such obstructionists, because they are such bad people, they are so evil, they won't allow things to happen, we've got to invoke the nuclear option and blow up the Senate. And so Harry Reid comes along, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, and says, well, okay, you don't have to blow up the Senate. We'll compromise with you. We'll give you some of your judges. There are just a few of them that we just think are a little too over the edge. And we have, after all, passed 95% of your judges, whereas you only passed 65% of Clinton's nominees. And so Frist, at that point, had to say, well, we're not. I don't think we can do that. We can't. Let's not talk about this in front of TV cameras. He was left mumbling. What could he say? Don't want to go there. We're going to blow up the Senate anyway. Why? Because this is a dress rehearsal for the Supreme Court nomination. They don't want the filibuster to be in place, to be available to the Democrats when they nominate a true right-wing crank to the United States Supreme Court, or two of them, or three of them, or four of them. And there could be that many. You have Justice Ginsburg, who has had cancer. You have Justice Kennedy, who has had health problems. You have Justice Obviously, Chief Justice Rehnquist has throat cancer, thyroid cancer. And there's another one, I'm forgetting which one, is also quite elderly right now. Unfortunately, it's not Thomas in my dreams, or Scalia. Could you be a Democrat? So anyway, that's what I think the real agenda is. The real agenda here is to blow up the Senate in preparation for single-party rule so that the Senate will simply be a rubber stamp to George Bush, whatever George Bush says, and no more balance of powers, no more advice and consent, just we're all singing from the same hymnal here. Pass it through. Okay, our question for the day, could you be a Democrat? You could be if you believe in self-government. Democrats believe in self-government, as Mark Shoemaker writes on BuzzFlash.com. Democrats believe that government must be useful and responsive. If you agree, you could be a Democrat. The Democrats abhor and will rebel against government that is narrow, self-interested, and authoritarian. Democrats believe the democratic government is the best tool ever devised to bring the diverse people, interests, and resources of a complex society together. I have to say, by the way, I think most independents believe this, and certainly Greens and progressives believe this. Democrats don't believe in big government, but they do understand that solutions to big problems or the achievement of big goals sometimes require big resources. Nothing wrong with that. Democrats believe that people have the right to, and in the case of protecting their liberty, must limit and protect themselves from all abuses of power, whether it's government power or corporate power. And progressives and Greens and even the old-fashioned Republicans get all this stuff. It's just that there's not many of them left. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And who's gonna pay the bill? Who's gonna pay the bill? Not Rush Limbaugh, not George Will, not those chicken hawks on Capitol Hill, not the tax cut billionaires. You know the drill. You're gonna pay the bill.
And welcome back. Hobgob in the chat room tells me the other name I was looking for was Justice Stevens. Yes, thank you very much. The possible fourth Supreme Court justice who could be replaced during the Bush term, which would just throw the whole thing, out the window. I mean, you could turn over. This would be a complete turnover, a complete rollover of the Supreme Court in conservative hands. Wyoming, on the other hand, another kind of turnover is happening across the United States. Wyoming, Montana, New Mexico, and Arizona, as well as the swing states of Oregon and Washington, have all elected Democratic governors. Or as the Republicans would say, Democrat governors. Actually, Democratic governors. It's interesting. That's how you know that you're reading this, an editorial in the L.A. Times. It's not been tainted by right-wing propagandists. Democratic governors, they refer to them as. Democrats picked up a House seat and a Senate seat in Colorado and won both houses of the legislature. Democrats took the Montana legislature to go along with their new chief executive. John Kerry had strong showings in New Mexico, Nevada, and Colorado. In fact, had he carried those states, he'd be president now. And talk to the folks who count the voting machines, maybe he did. Speaking of John Kerry and the Democrats, back to this op-ed piece on BuzzFlash today. This is great. You might be a Democrat if you believe that people have the right to, and in the cause of protecting liberty, must limit and protect themselves from all abuses of power, government or corporate. You might be a Democrat if you differ from today's conservative Republicans in that you are an idealist rather than an ideologue. If you believe in the inherent potential for good in people and in the ability of people to create good by working together, Democrats do not, like the Republicans, believe in their own moral superiority or in the absolute infallible truth of their own ideas, writes Mary Shoemaker on BuzzFlash.com. She says, Democrats believe in individual rights, personal liberty, and personal responsibility. You know, here's the problem with generalizations like this. You have to say many Democrats, because I can't say that these things are things that all Democrats believe in. Clearly, you've got corrupt Democrats like Torricelli. You've got, or Torricelli, or however you say it. You've got right-wing Democrats like Zell Miller and Joe Lieberman. And I'm just not willing to give this to them. Democrats are guided by undying moral and humanitarian principles rather than constantly changing social values. These principles are honesty, fair play, social justice, economic morality, political equality, freedom of conscience, individual integrity, respect for others regardless of station in life, gender, race, age, or religion, or inherited resources and privilege, and an undying commitment to self-government free of the authoritarian coercion of church, monarch, or in this modern age, corporate or other elite and unaccountable power. Well said. Well said. Thanks for being with us today. I do appreciate it. We will see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Have a great one.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.